welcome into this week's edition of New Track Record Podcast. Caleb Hatch with you. Justin Kinney will be joining us later on in the episode. But right now, I am joined by Racer.com's Chris Medlin, their F1 writer. Chris, thanks for coming on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Caleb. Good to be here.
Now, first off, I want to start with the thing that kind of triggered why we wanted to have you on. That was your article on Racer last week about Haas pulling Romain Grosjean's IndyCar sponsorship after the Bahrain crash. There's been a lot of discussion back and forth on his comments. Would you say that what he said was maybe more off the cuff and kind of a way for him, like you mentioned in a thread on Twitter, to kind of opt out of this after the crash?
Yeah, I do think so a little. I think it kind of was more reflective of the fact that at the time he was interested in it, but there was no signed deal and they weren't really massively deep at that point. It wasn't like he'd given him money and said, yeah, we're doing it, and then turned around and said no. It was more that Roman had asked him, do you want to? And he was like, yeah, this could work. So it's still early days. I mean, Roman was still finalising his own deal at that point. So I think it was more that it was going in a positive direction, and then it got stopped off the back of the crash, and it was maybe that Gene just felt, actually, from what I got as well, and gathered from Haas as an F1 team, is it might not have gone down too well if he'd spent more money sponsoring a new series, having had to drop those drivers from F1 because he was needing to save money with the F1 team. And that was just making it a more streamlined kind of operation. But, yeah, I just don't think it would have looked great. So I think that probably had got through to Gene by then as well, and he'd maybe sat on it and stewed on it a bit. And then this was more of an opportunity. But similarly, who am I to say, in the sense of I've never owned an F1 team, and to see one of your cars go through what happened with Roman in that crash. I mean, I was there in Bahrain, and it was terrifying at the time. So it could well be one of those things where you're like, you feel like you've escaped something and you just don't want to tempt fate again. So that might have played a part too.
Now, obviously, IndyCar is off the table for now for Gene Haas. Do you think that's an area that he would entertain, though, in the near future?
Potentially. I do feel it was the links with Roman that really opened that door, because the way he talks about both Roman and Kevin, but certainly Roman because he was one of the first driver that they confirmed when Haas entered F1, that Gene says, you know, the team weren't giving them a good car in Formula One, and these were two experienced, quick drivers who deserved a little bit more from the car and were capable of being further up the grid than they were being offered. So I feel like he almost felt like he owed it to Roman a bit, to kind of try and help him out with his next step, seeing as he was heading towards a kind of more heavily backed driver model within F1. And I think that's why that door opened. So I don't think it was a case of him being desperate to do IndyCar or to sponsor a driver or a team in IndyCar, but it was more, that's where Roman's going and he could do us some help, so I'll get involved. But it will also mean that he's now looked at it a bit more closely and understood where it could benefit him. So I know Gene gets the exposure he wants from the US, from NASCAR, but he may want to expand it or try and hit different markets through IndyCar. That's the whole reason he got into F1, was because of the global appeal he could get from that sport. So he's a businessman first and foremost, and I'm pretty sure if this has shown him that a business investment will make sense in IndyCar, then he would do it.
Now, for Romain Grosjean in year one in IndyCar, what are some realistic expectations for him? Obviously, there's going to be a lot of publicity due to him moving directly from F1 to IndyCar, but what are some realistic expectations, you think, at least from the F1 side? What do people expect for Romain in year one?
So I think there's definitely some people in Formula One who kind of think that an F1 driver heading to IndyCar should excel. But they tend to be people who don't really follow IndyCar closely enough to really appreciate the differences, the challenges, and what a big test it would be. But I do think there's definite speed and raw pace in Roman that should shine through at some point in the first year. I think there should be a race or two that we really see him stand out as that driver who was on the podium a bunch of times. I think it was 10 podiums he got in Formula One. And I think we'd, as an F1 reporter, I'd be expecting to see the odd race weekend where it suddenly flashes up where Roman is, you know, top three, top five, really in the mix. Whether he's going to have that edge to win a race or two in his first year, I think, is asking a lot. You know, going to a new team, a whole new environment for him against some brilliantly experienced guys. I think it might just take him a little while to really find his feet to deliver wins. But I do think he'll be up at the sharp end a few times. He'll also have some tough weekends because, as we saw with the way Formula One's been. I mean, an IndyCar is a tough car to drive physically, but you're driving on the edge as well a lot of the time. And Formula One was the same, but he was in a tough car as well in the Haas. And when you're pushing that little bit extra performance, you make mistakes. And in IndyCar, because, you know, it's a more of a level playing field, you know that, you know, if you just find that extra half a tenth, that little bit more speed into a corner, you might find a lot of time compared to the other guys. So we might see some mistakes from him too. And I think that's what most people will expect, like an up and down season that shows his potential. But, you know, he might be an experienced driver, but in IndyCar, he's a rookie. So I think there will be errors too.
Now, Chris, his former teammate at Haas, Kevin Magnussen, already running for Chip Ganassi and IMSA and sports cars, do you think he's the next F1 connection to IndyCar?
Yeah, I think he could be. I mean, there's a lot of guys that are on the F1 grid that have a little look across at IndyCar and think that would be cool to do someday. And I think in a perfect world, they'd love to be able to, you know, have a go while they're still doing Formula One, but it's just not possible. So that's why you see so many drivers kind of turn to it after they finish F1. You know, they don't want to. Once you leave F1, it's very hard to go back in. So you kind of have to make a clean break. And I think what Kevin's done is at the right time, a lot earlier in his career than some other drivers have, is make that clean break. And go into a project that he's going to be excited about, IMSA anyway, but he knows the links that are there with Ganassi, and he knows that that could really open doors for him in the future. But he's been promised nothing. I had a good long chat with him in Bahrain at the end of last year, and he was so looking forward to getting over to the US and really getting stuck in. But he also said, you know, they didn't have talks about the IndyCar seat or anything like that. It wasn't like Ganassi came to him and said, hey, if you drive for us in IMSA, you might get an IndyCar seat in future. He just knows that within that organisation, if he impresses, then maybe that sort of thing could happen. Whereas, obviously, if he went to certain other teams, there wouldn't be that link. So I do think it's all quite nicely set up for Kevin there. And I think he's the sort of driver that can really make it happen as well. He's a really, really high-quality driver who just never got the breaks in F1. And I think IMSA's going to suit him. I think IndyCar would definitely suit him. But I think just being in the US racing environment more than anything is going to suit him. And that's why he's made a really smart move, in my opinion.
Who do you think, who's currently in F1, would be that next guy or gal to try out the Indy 500 or IndyCar?
Tough one, because I guess we've had Fernando, who's back in F1 now, so I could say that he'd be the next, because I do think we'll see him back again at some point doing the Indy 500. I'd be surprised if Fernando Alonso doesn't head back at some stage once his F1 career is finally over. I've spoken to certain drivers about this before, and some are very keen for it, but some are like, there's different categories they'd like to be in. So someone like Kimi Raikkonen has said he'd like to head back to the US at some point, but to do NASCAR because it's so different. He had a little run at that 10 years ago now, and he'd be up for having another go in the future. Someone like Max Verstappen always interests me, because I think he'd be great in an IndyCar, but it's a long way off for him, and it's whether he'd have that appeal and want to come and do it after his F1 career. Sergio Perez, I actually think we'll see in IndyCar at some point. I think he's going to be someone that when he does finish in F1 and feels like his time is done, then I think IndyCar is something that he'll really want to get stuck into, because I think, again, he's someone who could do very well in there. Whereas at the moment, he just didn't feel that was the right time. He felt there were still opportunities and a bit more to give in F1. So he didn't actively look hard for an IndyCar ride this year. And then, fortunately for him, that was the right call, because he's ended up in a Red Bull seat. But I think that's been on his radar. And then guys like Daniel Ricciardo and Lando Norris at McLaren, they've got the links with the IndyCar team, of course, as well. Lando drives anything and everything on his sim at home. And he's done other racing as well. I mean, I was at Daytona for his debut there in the Rolex 24 a few years ago. And he made a real impression on a lot of people. And I think he enjoys, again, the kind of setup in the US. From that point of view, Ricciardo's the interesting one in the sense that he's talked himself out of ovals on the whole. So I don't think we'll see him do the 500, but I think we could see him in an IndyCar at some stage, maybe a similar deal to like Roman's running at the moment. So there's quite a few there that I think would be up for it, just because they just seem to really enjoy the atmosphere that the US offers, both from a racing point of view and a lifestyle point of view. So they're going to want to make that move.
Now, you mentioned Ricciardo, and he had some interesting comments the other day talking about his interest in the Indy 500 and maybe running Le Mans. But his Indy 500 comments, I think, caused a stir with IndyCar fans. I think we all can agree it was tongue-in-cheek, but he said, I mean, you have to turn left four times per lap. How difficult can that be? Is this something that he, you know, outside of the McLaren connection, really has any interest in, or is just a quote to cause a stir?
Yeah, so I missed that quote, but that would have been Daniel just winding people up. He's said openly before that it scares him, basically, the speeds and the accidents that happen there. And to be fair as well, racing drivers are a competitive beast. And for Daniel, one of his big strengths in Formula 1 has been on the brakes. He's one of the best late breakers there is. And you say to him, come and run a race where your biggest strength does not matter. And he's probably thinking, oh, I'm going to struggle. So that will have just been him being cheeky, I think. And I don't know if I can try and find the context at some point to see how he said it. But if it's written down, obviously it'll look way worse than it was probably meant in the first place. But it's definitely, Daniel spends a load of time over in the US, over in California already. And he really does love the racing scene there. He's, again, a big NASCAR fan, actually, but he definitely has said he would try a number of categories in the future. He likes the crossovers. He wants to go and do Bathurst as well with Zak Brown's United Autosport team. So he does look outside the F1 bubble. So IndyCar will be something he looks at properly, but it's just always been that, yeah, the ovals scare him, he said. And I think off the back of that, then he probably just uses the excuse that he doesn't think it's too much of a challenge if people then ask him seriously rather than saying, no, I'm scared of it.
Very, very interesting. Well, one guy who we know is not scared, Fernando Alonso. You mentioned you expect him back in the Indy 500 in the future. But with his return to formerly Renault, now Alpine, do you expect this season, maybe next season, and that's it for Fernando in F1?
Yes, actually. I think because next year is a set of new regulations where we should see a bit of a shake-up of the field. And if there's going to be one, then if you're already in the seat, you're going to get to see what your future looks like. And for Fernando, he basically needs Alpine to have made a good step with the brand new car in 2022 when all these changes come in. So this year, you know, we can't expect him to be doing anything other than racing in the midfield and maybe picking up a few podiums. But next year, there's a chance they'll be further forward. And if that does happen, then I think he'll stay around as long as the team wants him and as long as he can perform, if there's a chance of winning races. But if it doesn't happen and they're not one of the front-running teams and he's still in the midfield, then I think he'll be like, okay, I've helped with this project a bit, but I can't wait another 5 years for this to maybe improve. So that's where I think it would be, that it'd be 2 years and out. But it basically will depend on, in 12 months' time, how quick that new brand new car looks when we have new regulations. And that'll be the same for a lot of drivers. I mean, Lewis Hamilton hasn't committed beyond the end of this season, but if he does, I think actually how competitive a seat he's in will also come into his mind as well. So there'll be a few drivers that think that way.
Now, Chris, what Fernando did in 2017 with McLaren, basically giving him an olive branch to compete in the Indy 500 in a competitive ride that was capable of winning the race, has turned out into this, you know, connection between IndyCar and F1 that simply didn't exist before. How is IndyCar perceived in the F1 paddock, you know, in the years since that 2017 Indy 500?
I'd say it has improved its standing that was probably unfairly lower because people weren't paying enough attention to it. In the sense of IndyCar gets a rough ride sometimes from the F1 side in the sense of our races take place on a certain time zone, largely in Europe, and teams are flat out with that, and then they're normally in pack-up or travelling when an IndyCar race happens, so they don't see it. It's not put in front of them, whereas the opposite tends to be true from talking to a few IndyCar drivers, that F1 races are on a Sunday morning that they can, you know, that they'll quite often watch before their own race. So there's more of a connection coming back towards F1 from IndyCar than the other way, or there was in the past. But having a direct link, seeing Fernando go there, seeing how tough it clearly was, that he could run competitively, but other people obviously showing how it's done from, you know, like Scott Dixon, Will Power, and some guys that have not been in F1 but are big names in racing. That was, I think, a really positive thing. And it wasn't just the move to the 500 either. It was things like Fernando doing Le Mans and Daytona and going and racing against these guys in sports cars as well and on road courses. So I think all of that together started just to open some eyes a bit. And it showed the spectacle a bit more, and people were able to pay a bit closer attention because there was a direct link that they needed to be aware of. There's quite a big group of us that are always watching whatever racing we can, and we'll be working in the media centre after a Grand Prix finished, and we'll have whichever IndyCar race is on our iPads or whatever while we're working away. And teams will try and keep on top of it too, but I think it's not just about Fernando. It's actually, if we give some more credit there, that'd be Zach Brown, in the sense that he's really linked McLaren and the two series. And that just seems to put a bit more of a pathway, and then maybe more teams are looking at drivers that were there. Red Bull obviously picked up Pato O'Ward at one point and tried to get him to F1, but he didn't have the right super license. But it does mean that I think people in F1 are just looking a bit harder at IndyCar because they've got recent experience of clearly how good the standard is over there, by being able to benchmark Fernando against some of these guys.
Now, you mentioned Pato O'Ward, and it brings up an interesting question from the IndyCar side, with Pato and Colton Herta probably the two guys most likely to have a shot at moving from IndyCar to F1. Are they on the radar of F1 teams still?
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll see at some point, maybe even both Aaron McLaren FP guys having a go in an F1 car if the opportunity allows. I mean, obviously, travel's a problem now, and it depends. With F1, you can only run a two-year-old car if it's not an official test. There's only 3 days of official testing, so getting in a current car is tough, but maybe a slightly older one. So I think both of those guys could have a go, but Pato, especially with the way he's been performing recently, I think is going to be one that people keep an eye on. And beyond that, I think Colton has really shone. And I was chatting the other day about someone was hinting, I can't remember who it was, might have been Roman Grosjean, who was hinting that they've heard about an IndyCar driver perhaps sort of having a look at F1 or being looked at by some F1 teams. And when I asked a few people in IndyCar, everyone said, well, if it's going to be anyone, it's going to be Colton. But they didn't think it was actually happening. It seemed to be a bit of a rumour that was gathering a bit of momentum at the time. But yeah, Colton's definitely held in high regard as well. And it's always exciting to look around for young talent, wherever it's coming through. And there's been a streamlining of the kind of single-seater ladder over in Europe that in one sense helps, because if you're a casual follower, you can see which category each driver has to go through to reach F1. But at the same time, it drives the price up. It limits which categories drivers can come through in and impress. You have to follow one route. And I think it just means teams are then also looking a little bit outside that again. And by looking across the pond at IndyCar and some of the really impressive performances there, they then are thinking, yeah, these are guys that we should maybe be trying to get into a car at some point. So, yeah, I think like you say, Colton and Pato are definitely the two at the top of the list if anyone's making a short list at the moment of prospects in the US.
Now, we talked a little about short-term IndyCar and F1 and kind of how IndyCar is perceived, but 10 years ago, IndyCar wasn't even on the radar of F1. Is it at least looked at as a viable alternative now? And does the success of other people moving over, whether it's Alonso, Rossi, Ericsson, now Grosjean moving over, is that success making the jump make it more scintillating to F1 drivers?
Yeah, I think it's that, actually, because in one sense, what gave IndyCar and just US single seat to racing real credibility was when drivers came the other way and caused a real stir. And when you have someone like Montoya coming into F1 and really making his mark, obviously Villeneuve did something similar as well further back, then that always says to people, yeah, the best over in the US can jump in one of these cars and really compete. And we haven't seen that direction of movement for a while. But by seeing the F1 drivers going the other way and more of them doing it, then the current grid, they know who they've competed against. They see how hard some of them find it, but also how rewarding it can be to go to a field where everyone's got a better shot at success. Okay, you know, there's still clearly differences between teams, but it's not to the F1 level. And someone like Marcus Ericsson, who was really handy through his junior career and at times showed some real promise in Formula 1, but he just never seemed to quite get it done when it mattered. Certainly with Sauber, there were some really good performances that were for like a 10th or a 9th place and a point or two, but then there'd be an opportunity for like a top 6 that would go to his teammate Felipe Nasr. And it just missing those big results is what probably stunted his progress in Formula 1. But then he goes over to IndyCar and has some spells where he looks really competitive every now and then. And the drivers back in F1 are going like, yeah, if I don't succeed here or I don't have a competitive ride in F1, then I know I can go and do something a little bit more meaningful in IndyCar. So, yeah, it's definitely looked at as a more than viable alternative. I think basically every driver that was out of the seat at the end of last year in Formula 1 said, if I could, I'd love to race an IndyCar. If they weren't going to stay in F1, they wanted to do IndyCar. But obviously, that sounds so simple, and there's only limited seats, and it's still expensive to get an IndyCar ride. So it's not quite as easy as them just saying, I want to do it, so I'm going to go and do it. And that's why we haven't still seen quite the crossover. But there's definitely a big, big interest there.
Now, F1 back on the radar for Indianapolis and racing at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, possibly as soon as next year. Anything need to be done with the track to make it up to date for the FIA? And is the sanctioning fee going to be a sticking point like it was the previous time F1 was at IMS before it left?
So from what I can recall of the road course, I think it should be okay from an FIA point of view. They would head out and just double check it anyway, but if I recall correctly, I think it's still up to standards. And it wouldn't be anything that would be massive. It would just be a bit of runoff area type thing, where the garages these days might say they need to be a bit bigger, but there's so much space at IMS if needed. So, I think they'd be fine on that point of view. And there's definitely an interest there. I think the interest as well is sort of like a double one. You know, Liberty Media, as F1's owners, do really want to expand the footprint in the US, and Indianapolis is a really, you know, iconic place to be, and it's sort of plug-in and play if you do go ahead and do it. So I don't think the sanctioning fee would be anywhere near as high as it previously was. There's been a bit of a different model that's been trialled by Liberty. They've been more open to trying to find different ways of making races work in different places, Miami being one of them. The business model for that was very different. So I think there's definitely a discussion to be had there, and sources tell me some talks are taking place. I just don't know how deep they've gone. But it's definitely going to be an option because I think it works well for both. I think having Indianapolis having F1 as well is another big feather in the cap, and it brings even more international attention on top of the 500. So, I can see that as something that they'll be talking about, and a real possibility that it could happen at some point.
All right, a couple of F1 questions before we wrap up. Lewis Hamilton, obviously the title favorite going into this season. Who will challenge him for that two spot outside of his teammate?
I think it's going to be Max Verstappen again. Red Bull were the only team that could really get close to Mercedes last year. There's been a bit of a change in technical regulations with the way the floor is designed, and it's a cut downforce, so the cars might start the season a bit slower, but it can also really change the balance of the cars. And it's Red Bull's final year with Honda, so Honda have gone all out and upgraded their power unit, whereas to an extent that's beyond what most manufacturers were going to do. They fast-tracked something they had planned for 2022, which I think could make them very quick, but it also might make it a bit fragile. It's not too clear at the moment, but if it was as easy as just upgrading it and it's going to be rapid, then everyone would do it. So they've obviously taken some risks in that front. So maybe it'll be reliability that will say whether it's a sustained challenge that comes from Verstappen or if it's just sort of one-off at certain races, a bit like last year. But he's definitely the standout guy. I mean, he's an exceptional talent. He's always getting the absolute maximum out of the car. And you give him a sniff, and he really does hang on with the Mercedes drivers and make life hard for them, even when the car looks like it shouldn't quite be there. So, he's going to be the one that's going to worry Hamilton the most.
Now, Ferrari, can they move back into the top three?
They can. They do need their new power unit to be much better than last year's, but they've been talking fairly positively about it up to now. And just before we started the season last year, Ferrari were honest enough to come out and go, you know, this is going to be a slow start for us. We're not going to be particularly competitive at the start of the year. We didn't take it to be quite as bad as it ended up being. We actually thought that was just a sign of, you know, they'd be third quickest rather than fighting with the top two. But, last year was a disaster, and it can't really get any worse than that. So I do see them moving forward. It was such a low level they dropped to in 2020 that they've got to come back a long way. And it's a big ask over one winter to turn things around. But they've changed the car concepts because they know what the limitations were with the power unit before. The power unit should be better too. So I think we'll see a clear step. I do see them top three. I just do wonder if it might be a bit too much to ask them to regularly fight with Red Bull and Mercedes again. You know, we'll see it at certain races, but at others they might be a little bit adrift, I think.
All right, a team you expect to move up in the standings by the end of the season compared to where they were last year, and then a team you expect to slide back in the standings compared to last season.
So this is a tricky one, because I've just said I think Ferrari will be top three. So if I say Ferrari, then that seems like an easy answer. But if Ferrari don't do it, then I think Aston Martin. I think the fact that realistically that's the team that was racing point, should have finished third last year on points, but it's not clear if the whole car was legal the way they developed certain parts of it, so they had some points deducted. So they would have finished ahead of McLaren without that deduction, but McLaren were doing a brilliant job of maximising everything they have, and I feel like Aston Martin weren't. So that's a team I expect to see moving forward. Sliding backwards is a tricky one. I mean, dare I say it, I think maybe Haas might drop right to the back of the field because they're not really going to update their car again this year. With the budget they have, with the troubles they've had, with two rookie drivers, they're focusing very much on 2022, as all teams are, but I think they'll have done the bare minimum almost just to survive this year. And I think Williams might just improve a little bit more because they've been on a bit of a recovery. So if Williams moves slightly further forward and Alfa Romeo moves slightly further forward, then it will drop Haas right to the back, which will be painful, but it will be just for this 1 year if it is. And then I think we'll see a much more competitive Haas in 2022. So US race fans, if they're worrying about where Haas is headed, then I think brighter times are coming, but just not until next year.
All right. Finally, Drive to Survive Season 3 comes out March 19th. So a couple of weeks away. Will you have a starring role in Season 3 once again?
No, I'm not in Season 3. I was used basically Season 1 for sort of setting the scene and kind of explaining the sport a bit to new viewers. And then Season 2, we had a lot more drivers buy in. So at that point, they had the ability to get the drivers to explain things if they needed anything else sort of outlining. And now all that's in the can, they can revert to it whenever they need, but it's just ongoing storylines. So, there's no need for me for this one. There's a few new faces in it, but what's going to be really exciting to see, actually, is the work they did before the season properly got started. I know Netflix did a great job, or Box to Box Films, who create it, did a great job of getting to the teams and their headquarters and things, despite COVID and despite the shutdown, and to show behind the scenes just how bad it was and how difficult it was. And how it all changed. So I think that's going to be very cool to see, because that's something that nobody got to see. It's not like it's behind the scenes paddock stuff that I as a journalist normally would see, but viewers don't. This is something that was hidden to everybody. So that's going to be very cool.
Chris Medlin, the F1 writer for Racer.com. Chris, thanks for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be in touch if and when F1 returns to IMS in the near future.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Chris Medlin for joining us. And if you'd like to connect with us, you can find us at newtrackrecordpodcast.com. While you're there, sign up for our weekly email so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on many different podcasting platforms, of course, Apple Podcasts. And if you subscribe on there, do us a favor, give us a 5-star rating. If you're really nice, write a review. And you can also find us on Spotify, Overcast, CastBox, Player FM, iHeart, Podchaser, pretty much anywhere you find your podcasts, also at 1380thefan.com, and episodes posted on the weekends at wowo.com. And you can find us on social media, on Facebook, just like us, search for New Track Record. Our handle on Twitter is IndyCar Podcast, or you can email us, and the email is newtrackrecordpodcast@gmail.com. Justin Kinney joins us now, just
Hello.
In time for the mailbag.
Good stuff from Mr. Medlin. I look forward to Drive to Survive Season 3.
Except he's not on it. It's a what? Disappointment.
See, it's outrageous. But that's when we thought when we'd have Chris Medlin on, is he was so great in Seasons 1 and 2 on Drive to Survive, for sure. But I am interested in how Season 3 goes without, the normalcy of a regular season like we didn't have last year. But thanks to Chris for coming on. Had some great insight on some things and maybe a little bit more clarity on what we can expect with Formula One and IMS going forward.
For sure. And getting to the mailbag, first off, an email from one of our Canadian listeners, Pam.
Why do they have to be? Oh, I was going to say, why do they have to be Canadian? But
no,
okay.
She's shedding light on the BBC article that we referenced last week. She apologized for the lengthy email. I'm going to pick up for the bold part because I think that's probably the most relevant since she bolded it. So she says, sorry for the long-winded email, but BBC does not give the whole story, and I would not expect you to know the details either. As far as the possibility of the Toronto race occurring this year, I do not see any possibility of the Honda Indy happening this year with full vaccination, not expected until September due to the earlier holdup from the suppliers of the vaccine. The Raptors are playing in Tampa this season. The Blue Jays played out of Buffalo, and a Canadian division of the NHL was set up. The borders to the states have and will continue to be closed for a while due to the level of COVID in the states. There's no way our government will allow 20,000 to 30,000 people to get together in downtown Toronto in July. I do not see a street course in Vancouver, as the old circuit does not exist anymore due to development of the area. I think there is not much support in Calgary at this time, but that could change, and Edmonton ended because of poor attendance. I think Montreal would be the best option for a second race with the F1 track. I hope Toronto can keep going in 2022, as there are a large number of IndyCar fans in Canada, but if there are eventually no Canadian drivers or circuits, I can see it reducing in numbers further. On a positive note, thank you for your podcast. I never miss a week. Thank you, Pam.
Very
and she got
nice.
A lot into the vaccine supply. And a lot of it started with Canada ordering PPP from the Canadian location of 3M. But because the masks are produced at a factory in the States, with something that comes from Canada, and then Trump forced 3M to stop that order, and then everything, and again, not going to get all political here, but apparently Canada, you know, couldn't get that, and then Canada with the vaccines had issues on supply because they made orders, but it was from Europe, and plants, you know, in Europe needed to retool to meet demand, so they couldn't supply the Canadian orders that they are contracted to do, and the European Union vaccines held up as well due to a Belgian plant retooling. They tried to stop or slow deliveries to Canada. Moderna, same thing with supply. So they had ordered a lot, but again, they're behind on supply. And then vaccine supply is supposed to be more consistent now, and inoculations are increasing. But again, they're way behind compared to where the U.S. is at.
Well, and something, too, is that we completely forgot, and we assume this will be lifted, but who knows, is, you know, being able to cross the border.
Well, yeah, and she referenced that, and, you know, that hasn't been a case for a while.
That's
and
kind of an issue when you have transporters trying to get across the border. So, yeah, a lot of logistical problems for that Toronto race. And I think it's been the case for the last couple of years, to be honest. And, you know, is this the death sentence of Toronto? I don't know. Could we see the return of the Grand Prix of Montreal in some form or fashion at some point? That sounds, at least per Pam, like the best option, at least in the short term, for IndyCar in Canada.
Yes, and more comments from our Canadian viewers. First off, from Vicky Lynn 26, about us Canadian viewers, I don't exactly recall how many. That's old. Here we go. Sorry for the confusion, guys. LOL. PVR is Canadian for DVR.
Yeah. Well, I think something else when I say PVR. I think I hear PBR, and then I get all excited. But yeah, I thought that was correct, but I don't know.
And then a follow-up on Canadian races, she adds, about Canadian races, there's been too much development from hosting the 2010 Olympics. That's in Vancouver. The Olympic Village now occupies the south side of False Creek, where turns 7 through 11 were, and Concord Pacific still is developing the other side where start-finish, pit lane, and paddock was at. Did hear of the city looking at Formula E back in 2018, though there was no idea mentioned as to where to put it. We have a 2.2-kilometer 1.3-mile, thank you for converting that for us, by the way.
Yeah, thank you.
Road course in Mission.
Simpletons down
but
here.
But it's an hour outside of Vancouver and doesn't have any kind of transit to get there. Yeah, that's kind of a problem.
A little bit. Yeah, you got to be able to get to and fro.
She adds, had heard Rick Peterson, which is the P in Arrow McLaren SP, was trying to get a race into Calgary, but that has stalled too. Yeah, that's the last we've heard on another Canadian race.
Right, and I mean, I would be interested to, you know, since we've started this pseudo dialogue with our Canadian listeners, is what are the ratings like for IndyCar up there? I mean, it just sounds like none of the major networks or entities want to go the extra mile to have IndyCar on. I mean, are the ratings that pathetic? Because we hear all the Canadian fans are great and all this stuff, and they are. We see them show out, but are there just nobody watching? Are the ratings that bad that they don't feel like they need to put the entire season on quote unquote regular television? I'd be fascinated to know, because despite the, you know, I want to say poor but mediocre at best ratings in the United States, we still have every race on television in some form or fashion. So I'm wondering, are they worse in Canada or what? So
I know they're on Sportsnet, and some of them are on Sportsnet Plus or Sportsnet Now Plus, the last one being the streaming, and then Sportsnet Now I think is cable, and Sportsnet is I think basic cable. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I know that they're different competing TV networks, and Sportsnet is one, and I want to say the others is like the other is TSN. And I don't know if it's a case of Sportsnet is better or more accessible or right. less accessible. I'm not sure. So please fill us
in. Yeah, continue to educate us about what's going on up north for sure. And, you know, it is kind of, too, you look at Canada with, let's say, two sports networks, and you come down here. You have ESPN, and then you have NBC, and you have mix in Fox in there, even CBS. I mean, there's a lot more outlets for sporting events down here from what it sounds like. So, I'm just interested to know what the ratings are like up north.
IndyCar's not on CBC. Let's just leave it at that. I know that. R. Cole tweets, the LimeWire mention just divided your audience into three segments. My dad, myself, and my son. If I asked my boomer dad and toddler, they would both give me the same look.
Yeah, right? I mean, that was a great, what was it, like, you know, 6 years it was around, maybe 7 years, at least it's quote unquote heyday.
That was like early 2000s, right?
Yeah, I think it came out in early 2000s and maybe got to 9 or 10 years old. But I remember working jobs, and this is really in the weeds. Used to work at a job where we dubbed videos. So it was actually VHS videos. So you had a wall full of VHSs, VCRs. And you would have to put the master in and then record them all. And we'd get everything from instructional videos for companies to like adult films and all that stuff. That was actually, we'd fight over the days we would have to go in to do that. But I remember vividly, it's like while those were running, getting on LimeWire and trying to download music. And you would start like multiple downloads of the same song because you knew a couple would crap out. Would go really slow, or they would crash or whatever. So every song you were trying to get, you tried to download multiple times and see which one you got. And it was what a time to be alive back there with LimeWire, Napster, breaking the law.
Well, Napster was first, right? And then yes. It was LimeWire.
Yeah.
LimeWire was later because I think when I went to college, people had like these massive iTunes libraries. I'm like, where'd you guys, you know, get all this music? And they're like, LimeWire.
LimeWire, baby.
Oh, okay.
And then sometimes, like, you know, the downloads you would get would have, like, commercial breaks in them. Or one of the ones, a couple songs I had would have the instant messenger sound back and forth.
Yes,
because whoever was doing
the door slam.
Yeah. So whoever was uploading it or whenever they recorded it had those sounds. So it was like they were getting incoming AIM message or, like, the door slam, somebody was leaving. Or you hear the door opening. Maybe that's, we're dating ourselves again here, Caleb. AIM, instant messenger.
So-and-so is away.
And then, you know, you'd sit there for 5 or 10 minutes to try to come up, with the perfect away message.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
What conveys your mood right now, you know? And then you'd have, like, your away message, but also have those, like, permanent things underneath it you could always have in there. Oh, man. Takes me back.
A lot of pressure on those.
Yeah, right? You really, you know, that was really how you communicated your feelings, was your away message on AIM.
What was your screen name?
Boom X2 SJK. Boom Boom was a random nickname I was given in high school by a buddy of mine, and it kind of stuck. So Boom X2 SJK are my initials. So that's the rationale behind that one. What about you?
Mine is hilarious. It was Go Tennis 19.
Uh-huh.
And Go Tennis was just something we made up. I played tennis in high school, and something we made up, we just would say, Go Tennis, you know, like, as opposed to like Go Football
go
or
team,
basketball.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as a joke, and the 19's my favorite number. So that's how that came about.
How do you, okay.
And like all our gear said Go Tennis,
really?
Like, for the tennis team, like all our shoes.
we're going way off track here, but how do you come up with a favorite number? Because my wife and son both have favorite numbers, and I have none.
I mean, mine's my, like, birthday, you
okay.
know, in the month. So
gotcha. All right, that's fair enough.
Pretty but easy.
I'm always looked at home like, well, how do you not have a favorite number? Like, why would I have a favorite number? So
back on track.
Yeah, sure. But no, but this is going down memory lane where we're giving a peek to listeners a little more about the lives of the tortured lives of you and I.
We're showing our very boring and lame personalities.
Yeah, very much so. If you're still listening, thank you.
Matty McGinley, continuing on back to IndyCar, tweeted, couple things, guys. One, you think that some of the areas around IMS are dumpy? Well, check out Interlagos. It's legitimately not safe. We're not talking getting robbed at the Taco Bell unsafe. We're talking lose your life even during the day. Two, Gene Haas is an idiot. Gene Haas, I like to own racing teams and have my drivers drive my racing cars real fast, which is inherently dangerous. Also, Gene Haas, I don't want to sponsor a driver because the sport can be dangerous.
When you break it down like that, yes, it does sound a little city. But Interlagos is in Sao Paulo, right?
I believe Brazil? So, yes.
Yeah, I've heard like the good parts of Brazil are very nice and the bad parts of Brazil are very bad. What do they call those neighborhoods in South America that are like really poor?
Favelas?
Favelas, yeah, there you go. I was thinking of Vuvuzelas or whatever those things from soccer. South Africa World Cup. But yeah, that's interesting because obviously I've never been to Interlagos, never been to Brazil, but it's good to know because, you know, if you just go by the broadcast, and I know it's heavily censored and they're only showing certain things, you would think every Formula One track was in the epicenter of glitz and glamour of that particular country.
Not the case.
Not the case, nor would it be if it was at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
I posted this on Twitter a few days ago based on the livery reveals. And I think this came right after the Aero McLaren SP livery reveal, which those cars, A, look different. One has blue and orange, and the other has black and orange.
Yeah, not just like, okay, you got to pay attention to the
number.
The number
and
or the
front wing in
front wing, yeah. And like every race, they'd have to mention it. Now, if you're having trouble, but look at that front wing end plate. It's like, oh, geez.
I must say, those cars look really good.
They do, the absolutely.
I love Pato's car. Might be my favorite. I think I'd still go with Scott McLaughlin's car so far.
But I also feel like, to your point, I think anything that was different from last year, we would have liked because of the similarities between the two.
Correct. So on favorite liveries, I was surprised. A lot of people had Graham Rahal. R. Cole, definitely the Graham Rahal United Rentals livery. Incaptine 185, Graham's United Rental Machine, throwing it back to Bob's old Miller Light Ride. Poet Shevchenko, Sato's regular season white-red livery. That's that, like, shield one.
Yeah.
I think that's new. Tyler _ Allen tweets, Will Power's 5G and McLaughlin's PPG, but the Rahal cars look sharp, too. And then this one, which gets some praise, Nick J. Fletcher. We haven't seen it yet, but I feel like with Connor's mullet, it's literally going to be bald eagles, bourbon, Budweiser, American flags, fireworks, apple pie, duct tape, Monster Energy, Mount Rushmore, Armed Forces, Chevrolet, and ranch dressing. And then Connor today caused all the stir on social media.
Man.
As we record this Thursday, March 4th, for the day one of IndyCar content days, kind of like their media days, basically. But he got a mullet, and he apparently did it this morning before showing up.
And that is a hell of a mullet, I must say.
It's spot on.
Like, it is amazing. Like, you, 99 out of 100 mullets are like, what are you doing? That's the 1% that's like, yes, right?
Yeah.
You don't see that type of mullet excellence walking in and out of Walmart, where you see the majority of your mullets.
Well,
that
it's
is
just
excellence.
It was perfectly styled. I mean, business on top, party in the back, like, hit that to a T. I got to say, I was impressed.
Yeah, that's going to be a test. The true test is going to be at Barber, getting out of the car after practice or qualifying or race or whatever. He pulls that helmet off. Like, how does it look?
So, well, how does the Air Force feel about it?
Well, I mean, they got to love it.
I hope so.
How could you not?
Well, I mean, you know, they have their... Do they have that strict... I know the Army's pretty strict.
No longer. No.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, we can't do that now. That's discriminatory. But no, definitely you can have hair in the Air Force. I mean, Tom Cruise does. Come on, if Tom Cruise has in Top Gun, that would make that
very
realistic.
Yeah, because he's
in
the Air Force. Even though that movie is about the Navy.
I know, but I'm saying it goes for all armed forces. You can have your own hair now. You do not have to buzz it.
N.K. Harden, in reply to Nick J. Fletcher's mullet tweet, no other responses are necessary. You win, sir. Yes, agreed. Completely on that. All right, another topic to get to in the mailbag that I think is a good discussion for us as well, and it's the IndyCar TV schedule. Record 9 races on network TV. That's great. The only downside, and this is not IndyCar's fault, but Long Beach will be on NBCSN, and that's only because it was moved, and that's the new season finale as of right now. So it's a bummer not having the season finale on network, but again, that's because Long Beach was moved. It's a scheduling thing. These are all TV coverage time, start times, not green flag times for the schedule.
So what you're hoping is the green flag for each of these times is 2 minutes after the start of the broadcast time.
I mean, 5 minutes is a leeway
five
zone.
5 minutes tops.
I mean, let's be honest. We all know these green flags except for, say, like, I think Road America. And that's on NBCSN, so probably not. But Mid-Ohio is a noon start time. My guess is they'll have a green flag within 10 to 15 minutes since it's on big NBC. But majority of these, I mean, the race will start between 35 and 45 minutes after the coverage start. I mean, that's just how they always do it.
I feel like if there's any race on the schedule that would start soon after the broadcast began, what would you think? I mean, just based on start time and what could conceivably be before, I'm thinking, I don't know, even Barber, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if there's a hockey game at noon, maybe bleeds over a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I do like is there's a noon or 12:30 local time start time in 10 of the races. So
yes.
St. Pete is at noon. Indy 500 coverage starts at 11, but we all know the green flag will probably be about 12:20 or so.
Yep.
Then you have race two at Belle Isle, at Detroit at noon, Road America at noon, Mid-Ohio at noon, Toronto at noon, assuming Toronto happens. The IMS Road Course NASCAR IndyCar doubleheader race at 12:30. And then you have Portland, WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca, and Streets of Long Beach, all starting at 3 Eastern, but again, that's noon local on the West Coast. I like that because that's great for fans actually attending the events.
This is a schedule that, I mean, for by design or just by happenstance, does not cater to that getting the West Coast viewer that we see in so many different sports and so many different things. Oh, we can't start till 8:30 or 9 because of West Coast viewers. We see it in football a lot, right? This is, hey, we're going to do the best thing for our track, our fans in attendance, and all that. And hopefully this is not an anomaly. Hopefully this is the trend going forward.
And because NASCAR does not do start times until, you know, 2:30, 3:30, IndyCar races will squeeze in before NASCAR. And look, I get
maybe
you're not going to get
design.
The
maybe that I, you know, I get it.
You're not going to get the bump having the IndyCar race on after a NASCAR race. But look, to me, catering to your ticket paying customers is essential right now with these tracks having limited or no fans last season.
Right. And because, you know, what kind of times are we in, Caleb?
Unprecedented times.
We are.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because last week I was concerned, and our listeners can correct me if I'm wrong.
I was concerned that
we did not have an unprecedented times mentioned last week, which is just really a shame because we had a very long streak going of making sure that we got that we're living in unprecedented times in. And if we didn't get it in last week, I sincerely apologize. I know Justin apologizes.
Absolutely. It's been bothering me all week.
We have
frankly.
To stay true to our core values and beliefs here at New Track Record, and that is one of them. So thoughts on the schedule. Here's what people had to say. Chucky WX, love all the noon starts. Just about to buy my tickets for St. Pete, but wasn't too interested in a 4 p.m. start with a 2-hour drive. Hey, I have some tickets I'm trying to sell for St. Pete. And look,
ooh,
I know seat assignments aren't set yet, but these are reserved race day grandstand near turn one. This is on the main grandstand, but close to turn one. So you'll see the carnage, assuming they crash there in the opening lap. $125 a piece. I have 3 tickets. So I'm throwing the word out there. I'm trying to get rid of these. I can't go thanks to some family commitments. So would love to go, but I can't since I'll be out of town that weekend and not able to travel there most likely. So please message us, contact us if you are interested in the tickets. Shameless plug there.
Yeah.
Jeremy from HBG.
And interesting trades considered.
Yes, that too. Like Rich Energy, you know, if you got a case of Rich Energy, I would consider that.
Have we seen yet? I know because Rich Energy keeps teasing stuff, but are they going to be on a car in Formula One?
Well,
have we seen anything yet?
William Story tweeted something about how he was supposed to own was it Alpine? Or,
yeah.
Was that who it was? Was it Alpine?
It was something outlandish.
Aston Martin?
It
was like, come
yeah,
on,
it was
man.
Aston. Yeah, he was talking about Aston Martin.
Which those cars look really good.
Yeah, they look really good. Hey, when 007 and Tom Brady are involved in your reveal, you know it's going to be good.
That is true. Jeremy from HBG on the IndyCar schedule, dry erase board or pencil? I'm going to go with dry erase board, assuming that's the positive one, right?
I don't know. It's easier to erase a dry erase, I feel, than pencil. I'm saying dry erase. I'm feeling more. I will say this. I think I'm feeling more and more confident that the schedule gets run as is. I mean, you know, just a couple weeks ago, Caleb, we were talking about when we wouldn't be surprised if the road course was the season opener.
Correct.
And now I feel like now we have numbers for St. Pete, the cap. Barber sounds like they're close to announcing something. Texas is, you know, no holds barred all of a sudden. So I don't think they're going to have a problem. So a lot more encouraged. Continuing to see the numbers decline, more and more people getting the vaccine. I think we're trending in the right direction to, as we look at this schedule, say, I think a majority of this will be able to be pulled off. The big, you know, elephant in the room is Toronto.
Well, and looking at the schedule, Toronto is set for July 11th, and there's that month gap because of the Olympics. Now, if the Olympics happen, it's going to be hard to move Toronto anyway, as far as TV, unless they want to be stuck on CNBC, which I was watching a ton of CNBC, like, I don't know, a month ago during the first big snowstorm we had.
Yeah.
And watched a ton of Shark Tank, which I had never really sat down and watched that, but good stuff. Anyway, Toronto could move back to August 1st, for example, at the latest, but there are a couple other weekends if they have to move. They have at least, roughly a three-week gap in the schedule after Toronto so that they can, you know, move it back if need be. But, yeah, that's the one question mark on the schedule to me, and I think that's obvious. I think all the rest of the races, though, will run as scheduled with the way things are trending.
Good news. Good news all around, for sure.
Poet Shevchenko on the TV schedule. Nothing I can really complain about. The front half of the season will be really strong with TV. Yeah. First two races on network, that's huge. And then the Texas races on NBCSN. And then you get the road course, the 500. Then you have the gap, the week off, and then race one and two at Belle Isle, June 12th and 13th. But, I mean, it's a lot of network races to start out the season when IndyCar has that opportunity to get viewers. Because, look, let's be honest, by September 12th, when Portland hits, people are all about the NFL by then.
Yeah, between college football and the NFL, you're losing quite a bit of viewers, myself included. Not that I don't watch. My interest just goes elsewhere. My primary interest. You know me, Caleb. I watch every race on DVR, it feels like, but especially once we get into August and September.
All right, this tweet from Micah Hatch, my brother.
Oh.
Surprised no one mentioned the perfect attendance number outside of 100. 33% keeps with tradition, one-ups NASCAR, good publicity.
Yeah, sure.
I still think, though, we will be for sure where the way things are at, for sure at 50%, but reality is we could be at 75 or 100 because the 500, I was thinking it was a week earlier, but it's actually May 30th. So yeah, we're at the very end of May. That buys you an extra week.
Yeah, it's deep in May. Last day of May.
Second to last.
Second, is it 31 days?
Yeah.
Okay. I got to count on my knuckles. Did you do that when you were a kid?
What? No.
It works.
Does it really?
Yeah. Start on your, make a fist.
Uh-huh.
Start with your index finger knuckle.
Mm-hmm.
That's January. February is the in-between. March. So you go all the way down and then restart. And the little ones are shorter months. The big ones are the long months. January.
Wow.
March.
This is mind-blowing. I'm learning a lot tonight.
Yes. See? Something you remember from grade school. That, you know, when you get it older and you're like, what any of this stuff I'm going to remember when I get older? High school, college? No. But grade school? Yes.
So, for fans, what's your prediction right now?
50%. No,
I would agree. Do you think we could have full capacity? Do you think that is even a possibility?
I think that's too much too soon. as well as we have done. So in the state of Indiana now came out, you know, yesterday, now 50 and older can get the vaccine.
And then along with teachers, but that's a federal
thing, yeah, through a grant. So, but, you know, just a couple of days ago, it was 55. And a week before that, it was 60. So we're dropping pretty quick. And I think it's a little concerning. Like, if everybody 55 and older was getting the vaccine, I feel like they wouldn't be dropping it that quick with the lower demographics.
Well, it's just because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, they got shipments of that. And then that's boosting the number of people they can accommodate.
Which, can I say, I don't want the Johnson & Johnson one because it's only like, what, 75% effective?
No. You're looking at it all wrong. It's
100% against death, isn't it?
And severe COVID.
Oh. See, but they're spinning it like, hey, only one dose. But yeah, the other ones work.
No, but this one's better because it's only one dose and prevents death 100% of the time. And also,
how do they know that, though?
So far, because of the trials and
nobody died.
And then also with severe COVID. So to me, it's best case.
Really?
Look, you may still catch a mild case of COVID. I had a mild case of COVID. I didn't even realize I had COVID.
Yeah. I would say it was a less than mild then case for you, for sure. It was like a non-existent. Yeah. But okay, I got you.
This from Poet Shevchenko and Adam Stern tweeted this. Volkswagen Group considering entering F1 with its Porsche or Audi brand. It's for Andrew Benson F1, and Poet Shevchenko saying, third OEM time. Since ethanol money went out the door years ago, maybe open up alternate fuels, because that is what companies still in the combustion game are talking about. Look.
Ding, ding, ding.
I talked about this last week, and I'm surprised that you or really no one just seemed to latch on to what I was trying to say, because my realization was that it's not so much that it's not the right time or, you know, we're evaluating everything with, you know, Ferrari and they chose sports cars, which was duh.
Right.
Of course, you're going to race at Le Mans, which got moved back to August. I'm not sure if you saw that.
Yep.
But to me, I think the issue is what IndyCar's formula is right now is simply not attractive and it only works for Honda and Chevy.
Yeah, absolutely. And who knows how long it works for Honda and Chevy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we debated this back and forth, and not really debated because we ended up, you know, agreeing on a lot of things. And, you know, you look at the decision, a lot of decisions, but the most recent with Porsche and VW looking into Formula One. And, you know, as part of the commission meeting last month for Formula One, quote, the teams and stakeholders outlined some key objectives for the next power unit regulations from 2025 onwards. This is from our friend Chris Medlin at Racer.com. These were the five bullet points that they're focusing on from 2025 onwards that they can then sell to prospective OEMs. Environmental sustainability and social and automotive relevance. That's saying, you know, environmentally friendly fuels, exhaust, all that stuff. Automotive relevance. Every automotive company wants, how does this translate to the road?
And that is the key one right
yes.
there.
How does this translate to the road? Fully sustainable fuel, like we mentioned. Creating a powerful and emotive power unit. So, yeah, they don't want them, you know, just not, they want to be underpowered. They want to be as powerful as possible. Significant cost reduction and attractiveness to new power unit manufacturers. Those are the five. Which one of those, if any, is IndyCar focusing on? A powerful and emotive power unit?
No.
I mean, significant cost reduction? Attractiveness to new power unit manufacturers? We know that's a no.
No.
So I think the conversation has to change. The goals have to change. The goal should not be to add a third OEM. For IndyCar, for Penske, for fans, for teams, for owners, that should not be the goal. The goal is to continue your relationship with your existing two OEMs. Whatever Honda and Chevy want, you give them. You provide. And if that leads to an addition to a third OEM, then that's icing on the cake, right?
Correct.
The priority has to be preserving your relationship and keeping your two OEMs. That's where I think everything has changed. And I'm not saying IndyCar's not doing that. I think we've heard countless times about the dialogue that they have with those two OEMs. But I feel like they don't abandon the search for a third OEM, but I really think that the future of IndyCar needs to revolve around Honda and Chevy and what is best for those two entities. Because without one or both of them, IndyCar falls apart. So that needs to be the goal. I've reached a point, I think, Caleb, you're with me. I'm tired about hearing about third OEMs. I'm tired about hearing about fourth or what they need to do. The goal should be what you need to do going forward to hold on to Honda and Chevy, because we're already seeing Chevy announce that they want to be, is it carbon neutral? Is that what their goal is?
No, I think
is? Or all electric?
All electric by 2034 or 35.
Yeah, that means they want to get rid of an internal combustion engine in the next 10 to 15 years. And IndyCars run on internal combustion engines. And Honda, for a long time, Honda and Toyota were really the leaders in innovation in alternative energy and clean energy and, you know, making their power units in their civilian cars as economic as possible, right? And everybody else was really trying to catch up with those. So, Caleb, we talked about it today. And auto racing has all been about innovation, right? What's driving innovation on the road? And for a long time, it was the internal combustion engine. Those days are going to end pretty soon. So all the people that are moaning and groaning about back in your day, and you know, can hear the engines and all stuff, and Formula E is dumb, you can't hear them. That's where the automotive industry is going. They're going electric. They're going hydrogen. They're going these alternative energy fuels. And unless you adjust with the trends, with the future, then you're going to be left behind. Something that I think IndyCar is already woefully behind everyone else.
Well, and, you know, we talk about electric cars. Look at how far we've come just in the past, you know, 5-6 years. I mean, yeah, there are some other offerings besides a Toyota Prius. There's a Nissan Leaf and, you know, a few other random things, and then throwing that Tesla's, you know, very expensive models in the beginning. But look at where we're at now. I mean, Tesla is a lot more widespread. I see them driving around town here all the time.
Yeah, likewise.
Priuses are still popular, but then you got an electric Hummer with GM.
Yeah.
You have electric BMWs. You have electric Nissans.
You have electric trucks.
Yeah.
I mean, is it the Silverado has an electric version?
I think the Ford
F-150? One of the two big trucks.
A Mustang, Mach-E.
Yeah.
So,
which I thought was kind of ugly when I first saw it, but it's kind of growing on me, the electric Mustang.
Electric cars have a lot more torque, so they have a lot more 0 to 60 power.
Yeah.
That's the interesting part about this.
I mean, this is the thing, is that, you know, it's a lot of the older generation that they don't want to see anything change, and of course, they're, you know, they don't want electric car, they'll never watch, blah, blah, blah. That's the way... That's where the future of automotive, design is going. And if auto racing doesn't adjust, then they'll be ancient. They'll be non-existent. So we're not here to say that IndyCar should go to fully electric or hydrogen.
Oh, no.
I think
this is something that's definitely 5, but maybe 10 to 15 years away as far as being the auto industry being close to fully electric in the U.S.
Yeah, I feel like, and maybe it was the old guard, you know, the IndyCar owner, and then you just, you know, they were from that era where, you know, of course we're going to have these engines. I think if there is anybody, and not just Roger Penske, the Penske Group, can be visionaries and see where the future is going, because IndyCar is behind. We're seeing it. People are going sports cars instead. Now they're going Formula One instead of IndyCar. They'd much rather spend hundreds of millions of dollars in Formula One to likely not win a single championship, because it's more relevant to their on-the-road technology, as opposed to joining IndyCar and spending tens of millions of dollars and probably winning some races and doing the very same thing.
That sums it up pretty well.
I mean, you know, the key word is innovation. You know, for a long time, the Indy 500 was about innovation. Right? Everybody was bringing the newest and greatest technology from, you know, the 20s and 30s to now. The innovation now is going toward alternative fuels. And so it's just going to continue to follow the trend. Just as the Indianapolis 500 has done for 100 years in innovation, that's the direction that innovation is going.
Well, it innovated for 75 of those.
Wow, yes.
100 years, if we want to get technical. Yeah, there are innovations at the track, you know, obviously the safer barriers.
True.
But as far as the cars and the chassis.
But that's spec cars for 20 years. But, you know, it comes back to the thing, look, we have to get out of the mindset of finding a third OEM. We have to get into the mindset of protecting and taking care of the two we have. Because if you lose one, you're in a world of hurt. And if you lose two, what do you do?
That is true.
I mean, the only really part of non-spec we have is engines, right? I mean, you don't want an entire field being run by Honda or run by Chevy. So forget about finding a third.
And that was the case from 2006 through 2011. It was all Honda.
Yeah, right? And I want to say there was not as much spec elsewhere on the car than there is now.
Yeah, they could do a lot more with the car back then.
So the engine, yeah, it sucked for everybody to have the same engine, but there were other ways to find an edge with the car.
And they had multiple chassis for a couple of those years until the end.
Right. So, yeah, don't think, okay, they did it before, they could do it again, because there was a lot more in terms of what teams could do to change up their configurations and how they run than what we can now. So let's just forget about third OEMs. And just focus on whatever Honda and GM want. When you have meetings, just fine. Yeah.
And international races, which I'll get to later.
Oh, okay. Good. I'm glad we have an international race.
This from NK Harden. Hey, look, it's our annual Things Are Turning Around for Foyt article, a tradition unlike any other. I'll admit, I didn't read it.
Me
you
either.
Said you didn't read it, so
I've
we'll
read
move
that
on.
Story every year for the last 7 years. I don't need to this year.
But again, as always, thanks to everyone for sending their tweets, emails, everything. We appreciate it. Time for news and notes, and I think the first news item, Pietro Fittipaldi finally confirmed at Dale Coyne Racing with Rick Ware Racing running the ovals for Romain Grosjean. Not a surprise. In fact, I saw a Brazilian report late last week, thanks to the IndyCar Wikipedia page, that the deal would be announced March 1st. Obviously, that didn't happen. Then Planet F1 had an article. But Pietro Fittipaldi, again, running all the ovals, including the Indy 500 for the 51 car. Not a surprise. I think we expected this. A couple of notes with that. Nathan Brown of the Indy Star saying Pietro said he still holds dreams to go full-time in either IndyCar or F1, both places, with his grandfather, Emerson Fittipaldi, has won titles. He's the reserve driver at Haas F1, so that's where he's also relevant. And some other notes.
Well, it's not Haas F1 anymore.
Well, yeah, it's
Ural Kali Haas F1.
Yeah. Yeah, if we get real, real technical with it.
I'm sure that was part of the deal. They paid several million dollars for that title.
Now, so remember how Romain Grosjean said he'd be interested in running the track formerly known as Gateway?
Yes.
So he talked about running at Gateway. It's an article, motorsport.com. And if that were the case, Dale Coyne and Rick Ware would run three cars for that weekend, including Pietro Fittipaldi. He said, we haven't really talked about it yet. I think there are high chances that I would like to do it, but let's see how the first races go. Then we can assess. So still interested in Gateway. That's courtesy of motorsport.com. And then he still has another test with Dale Coyne. That will be March 29th at Sebring. Carlin also expected to be at the same test. You would assume Max Chilton will be a part of that. And Grosjean on the Gene Haas sponsorship thing that we talked about earlier with Chris Medland confirmed that Haas discussed sponsoring his IndyCar ride. Grosjean saying, I felt like it could be a great story. Obviously, they decided otherwise and declined to go into any further reasoning that, according to Nathan Brown. So that's your Romain Grosjean update, I guess.
I think this is going to be a weekly occurrence.
Yes.
For Romain Grosjean. So
a couple of other notes from Content Day as we continue on. Will Power in a contract year. That confirmed by Jenna Fryer. Also, Colton Herta, his strategist, will be Brian Herta.
His old man.
That will be interesting to watch. Also, I noticed that AJ Foyt Racing tweeted this out, some pictures of Sebastian Bourdais. He's got a fire suit with the black and coyote orange on, so that's cool.
Hey.
Good look there. Let's see what else from Content Day. Oh, this quote from Ryan Hunter-Reay, this courtesy of Jenna Fryer, I thought was pretty funny. Ryan Hunter-Reay on Andretti downsizing this season, deadpans, we're still going to have 14 cars at Indy.
All right.
Thought that was
great.
thought that was great.
That seems down from previous years.
That's true. So that's kind of the recap of Content Day. They'll do more tomorrow with more drivers. Wouldn't be surprised if there are some more announcements. And speaking of announcements, Justin, I think this is the other big news of the week. And St. Pete will have fans.
Yeah, and quite a bit of them.
Today, 20,000 per day is kind of the total. And the race will be held the same weekend. They've, you know, worked. The city of St. Pete has worked with, you know, the health department and all that to get this cleared. So that race will be run again, 20,000 fan maximum for each day at St. Pete. That's similar to what they did last October. So
now how much do they usually get on a race day?
Hard to say. Street courses, it always looks like more people than
there's less places to sit, obviously. I mean, I don't know.
The grandstands probably are, I don't know, 15 to 20,000.
Okay. So maybe half of the normal, you know, maybe usually 30 to 40, maybe?
I saw somewhere that they estimated attendance a couple of years ago, back when it was full fans, obviously. It was like, I don't know, 147 or 149,000, which they always bloat the
on race day?
No, 3 day.
Oh, okay.
They always bloat the totals.
Yeah,
I mean, we all know that.
Yeah. That's still a lot more than I thought.
So, questions on tickets. So, 3 day tickets will be on sale March 18th at 2 p.m. Eastern to the public. 3 day ticket renewals are underway now through March 15th. And again, gpstpete.com for all the details. If you are like me and had tickets for the original race last year, details supposed to come out via email, I think, in the next week or so with that. And then Nathan Brown of the Indy Star, IndyStar.com, had an update on Barber as well. And he's saying that ticket sales have not yet begun for Barber. But Gene Hallman, president and CEO of the Bruno Event Team that runs the Honda Indy Grand Prix of Alabama, told IndyStar this week that his team hoped to finalize attendance plans by the end of this week. So that's a couple of days.
Nice.
The venue still plans to host fans, but is waiting on capacity allowance guidance from local health officials. And of course, we all know in Texas at TMS, tickets are on sale, and that's following Governor Greg Abbott's removal of the state's mask mandate and lifting of capacity restrictions on all businesses in Texas. So that's where we stand pre-Indy 500 in month of May. An update from Robin Miller of Racer.com in his weekly mailbag. No hardline percentage or numbers have been decided, but I know Roger Penske and Mark Miles want as many as possible. Likely be April before it's determined. I know that's hard on out-of-town fans like yourself, but IMS is at the mercy of health departments and COVID numbers. And then also a follow-up from Doug Bowles and another question. At this point, no determination has been made on whether we will be able to allow traditional bronze or silver badge access this year. That's from Doug Bowles, president of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Excellent. So just hurry up and wait. We wait a little bit longer.
Speaking of the Speedway, a couple events and things of note. I don't know if you saw this, Justin, but Michael Schumacher, Paul Page, elected to the IMS Hall of Fame.
Yep.
I think that's well-deserved for both of them. Also, this from Nathan Brown of the Indy Star. He tweets, it appears some version of last October's Indianapolis 8-Hour will return October 15th through 17th. And it's listed on the IMS online calendar. The TC America Sports Car Series lists IMS on their calendar as well. So that will look to return, which I find interesting.
And very nice.
Race announcements. One other IMS thing. This is a big deal. They're having a COVID-19 vaccine clinic March 5th through 7th. So they have details at vaccine.coronavirus.in.gov, and you can enter your zip code 46222 and register. Of course, that's if you're in the Indianapolis area. Or if you really want to drive down and do that, I guess you can. But again, that's March 5th through 7th, so that's pretty cool that they're taking part in that. And, the other big news, another race, the second Texas race now is a sponsor. It'll be the XPEL 375. They're already a Team Penske sponsor. So,
the other one is the Genesis still, remains the Genesis 300?
I believe so, but I'm not sure.
I imagine.
I think it is.
Yes, it is. Okay. Genesis 300 is May 1st. The XPEL 375. So that tells me, are they the same race distance and one's miles and one's kilometers? Are we playing that game?
I think so.
Okay.
And want to get to some rumors from our insider.
Deep Throat got some stuff this week.
Yeah. So it was quite a couple of weeks telling me that quite busy lately. But as I pull up some updates here. I know mentioned that Connor Daly's still in line for the ovals with Carlin. And Connor had some comments today during media day that basically said, like, yeah, he's open for opportunities to fill out his schedule. I don't think that's a surprise.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we have here. Montoya is set to run a handful of races for McLaren this year, not just any. That would be awesome. So that's kind of the update with Montoya. And, you know, this comes after last week. I think I saw in an article they want to run him for the Indy GP. Then he did that test at Laguna Seca the other day, along with Pato and Felix. A lot of drivers there earlier this week, so that's a good sign. Let's see what else that we have. McLaren won in a third car last year before COVID changed that. JPM could run 4 to 6 races this year for McLaren. And Zach Brown has won a JPM as long as he's been gone from Penske. So those are some of the updates there.
Nice.
Carlin's still waiting on funding to confirm Connor for the oval races. So apparently that's the issue. Also, looks like the Indy 500 could have at least 50% capacity as the vaccine rollout in the U.S. is going strong. It could be done by the beginning of May. And so that's where we're at.
So all positive trends.
Yes.
Let's keep it going, folks.
Yeah, we're being too positive, right?
Let's find something.
Do I need to find something negative?
Negative.
I don't even think I can. Oh, no, I found something negative. Here
all
we
right.
go. Here's a quick positive. Indy Lights will have halos for next year, which I think is pretty cool.
Very F1-esque.
But here's,
not as robust, I'd say, but.
Here's the negative. This from John Orand of Sports Business Journal. NBC is about to double its payout to the NFL. What does that mean for other NBC properties like the NHL and EPL? Comcast Brian Roberts, there will be tough decisions where we have relationships that maybe won't be continued.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun. You know, this kind of leads me into something that I heard this morning, Caleb. I mentioned to you that Amazon is in a bidding war for Thursday Night Football.
Correct.
To where it would be exclusively on Amazon Prime. We've seen in the last couple of years simulcasts where it would be on one station and then also Prime. But Amazon trying to land Thursday Night Football, and nobody's going to outspend Amazon. So if Amazon wants it, they're going to get it. And so when we talk streaming here, and when is it going to flip, and when do we see, you know, live sports consistently on stream as we look forward with IndyCar and potentially, you know, going forward on Peacock if they're brought back by NBC. This would be I don't know if, Caleb, we could say the first big domino to fall, but, you know, NFL games weekly being only on Prime would be a giant step in the streaming battle and the streaming discussion when it comes to live sporting events.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a huge shift, but also would mean that the NFL is not only the leader, I think, in that shift. Like, yes, everyone has streaming stuff, but the NFL taking a game and only having it accessible via Prime, I mean, that is a big change.
Well, we've seen it in they've done it here and there, and they've done it where, you know, it's only on NFL Network. You know, some of those Saturday games end up only on NFL Network, so you don't have them, you can't watch them. But this would really, you know, every single week, 17 games, 17 weeks on Prime. And then you wonder, because who usually has the Thursday nights?
Fox has it now. It was CBS before.
Okay. You know, how does that change things in the playoffs? I mean, could they get a playoff game potentially?
True.
Just on Prime. So that's something to keep an eye on as we follow sports and live streaming, and we feel like eventually that's going to affect IndyCar. Eventually there will be a live IndyCar race only on stream.
This from Racer.com's Marshall Pruitt, and I mean, not really a surprise. I think this is more of a, sure, I'd love to do it, but sports car driver Kamui Kobayashi says he's interested in trying IndyCar. I thought it was notable that he raced in Super Formula and does that, and they run the same chassis with Dallara as IndyCar does. So
yeah,
I thought that was notable as far as being able to adapt to the car.
And I feel like we've had that Kobayashi discussion when we looked at Super Formula and potentially who could be the next driver to come over. And I think we had that, you know, even like a month or two ago, we were talking about
if Yuki Tsunoda flames out of F1, I think he would also be a prime candidate.
Well, when we talked about it, you know, who will be the next, you know, there'd be a tremendous void. I think it's a void. It's something that we've taken for granted with Takuma Sato that, okay, Japan's just going to be interested in any car.
Kind of like the Brazilian drivers. I mean, you have Elio and TK, but
right.
Pietro Fittipaldi is the only other guy now.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of dried up. But, you know, you see, you know, you and I both see it in May, the mass of Japanese media that are over to cover the race. And I can guarantee you the interest wouldn't be there as much if there was not a Japanese driver competing. And as Takuma Sato gets older, granted, he doesn't seem to age, you feel like you have to replace Takuma Sato at some point with another Japanese driver to continue that interest. And if it's Kobayashi, you know, who's in his mid-30s, but as we've seen other this year rookies in IndyCar succeeding in other series and then coming over, that would be a big replacement or a compliment, even if Takuma Sato sticks around for more than a couple years to really add to the series. But again, Caleb, this is just one question that he answered. It's not saying he's looking for a ride. It's not the ride's imminent. But I think he's a name to watch going into next year's silly season for sure.
All right, a couple of quick things to wrap up before we get to tweets of the week. Michael Andretti piloted the Guinness World Record-setting car for the fastest edible car. And the car was made out of cake. It's on thedrive.com.
Tasty.
Marco Andretti, interested in running sports cars. I don't think this is a surprise. This would be, after he tested at Sebring the other week, may co-drive an LMP3 Ligier with his cousin Jared Andretti in at least a couple of IMSA WeatherTech sports car races this season. That courtesy of racer.com. And let's see. Oh, before I get to the international race thing, which I think is fascinating. I'm teasing
is it?
That.
What's that?
I just keep teasing it because it's fascinating. Nathan Brown of the Indy Star mentioning this. IMS Museum went in a partnership with Indy-based Sports and Entertainment Travel. I believe one of my former coworkers works there, so I may have to hit him up for more details. But exclusive overnight travel package, museum visit, VIP track tour, visit to AJ Foyt Racing, lodging at the Courtyard Speedway, lunch, dinner, and a drink at a local restaurant.
Can you go to the winery?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's right down the street.
Well, I know. Is that part
pretty
of the,
expensive,
part of the
though. Deal? $499 for one, $399 a person for two, $369 a person for three, $359 for four. Sports and Entertainment Travel.com for the
nice.
Details.
Check it out. This is random, but I was reading up a little more on Kamui Kobayashi.
Uh-huh.
And there's a picture on his Wikipedia page of him driving a Sauber in the 2010 Malaysian Grand Prix. Talk about a fugly car.
Oh, the noses on those cars back. There was an era of very ugly cars, like 2008 or 9 when Braun won. Those cars were pretty ugly.
Yeah.
And up until like 2013 when they revamped the engines.
I mean, yeah, even the back end.
Ugly.
I think the back end is what gets me. It's just huge and gross. But anyway. Because it was like it had that fin that goes all the way back and attaches to the wing almost.
So like a extended shark fin.
Yeah. It's all one piece, actually, looking at it. It goes all the way back and then eventually just turns into the rear wing. Man, that's ugly.
Connor Daly is going to be racing in the Camping World Truck Series race Friday. So as we record this, it's Thursday. So you'll probably already know the result depending on when you listen, but starts P36, so good luck. Nice Motorsports, I think it's the iRacing car again, but good luck to him, and I believe it's his only truck race he's scheduled to do this year, but we'll see if any more opportunities come about. Okay, I've teased it constantly.
Yes.
International races. So earlier this week, and I looked into this because IndyCar had a poll on it, was the season opener for 1971, it was an international race, Rafaela, Argentina.
I read this story. It was fascinating.
Yes. So I read the story on racer.com, and I think Robin Miller had the column, $100,000 that the promoter offered at this track, which still exists to this day.
Yeah, it's a three-mile oval.
It's huge. It's outside of the town of Raffaello, which is about 100,000 people now, so it was a little smaller then. About 2 hours in from Buenos Aires on a bus ride that the drivers took to get there. But, it drew 40,000 people. They're pretty sizable fields. I think 27 cars.
You could even watch some of it. They have video.
Yeah, I watched that YouTube video. Then I did some more research on it. And I think the thing that I didn't understand until doing more research, because I just kind of went down the rabbit hole with this.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, Argentina, that doesn't make any sense. I couldn't name an Argentinian driver. And then I forgot. Well, Juan Manuel Fangio is Argentinian in F1. And so they were, 15, 20 years removed from his run in F1. And so there's a robust motorsports scene in Argentina at the time.
And they got him to run the race, didn't they?
He didn't run the race. Okay. No, but I think he may have done something for the race.
I'm sure he did part of the race, yeah.
But they got an Argentinian driver who ran, and it was two starts.
Yeah.
He was a rookie, and I think he finished like 12th and 9th or something. I mean, he had a pretty solid run considering his first races on an oval and in an Indy car at the time. But fascinating race. Track still exists. Obviously, they're never going to return because why would they?
Hey, which I would welcome that discussion over the Michigan and
the racing
Milwaukee.
Would be phenomenal. I mean, I can't imagine what people got to see for that. It had to be incredible.
I mean, the front stretch and back stretch, I mean, longer than Indy.
Yep.
And it was shaped kind of like a paperclip. It was just there was no short chutes or anything. It was just two long, gradual turns and then just a freaking huge long straight. I mean, straight, basically, on both sides. It was amazing. And Armco barriers on both sides. I did notice that on the picture, the glory days of Armco.
And no, back then, they didn't really have catch fence except like on a straightaway.
Catch fence there. Is this the photo I'm looking at? Like on the front stretch pre-race with all the cars lined up in the van, there's nothing.
The oval is, as far as I know, not really in operation, but they do have a road course there that is still used this day.
Apparently, they put in like two chicanes on the oval.
Yeah.
So, to slow them down, apparently. It's a pseudo oval road course with the chicanes in there. Let's go back.
I'd love to see it, but again, there's no demand for it. And I mean, good for IndyCar at the time. I mean, it was USAC, but $100,000 back in 1971. I don't know what that equates to in current dollars, but I mean, that's got to be well over $1 million. And if you're going to have a promoter say, here's $1 million, you want to come race here? IndyCar is, of course, going to say yes. And
yeah, they're not getting those calls anymore. Caleb.
True. Well, due to COVID. But I forgot about the most interesting detail. It was a non-points paying race, and entries were lagging. So like 10 days out,
they made it a points race.
Changed it to a points race, and then everyone showed up except Foyt, who was already doing a NASCAR race.
Which he won.
Andretti, who I guess had a testing crash, and then his backup car wasn't ready or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then he had F1 like the following weekend. So Foyt and Andretti not in it, but Al Unser was there, and I think he or Bobby Unser had some sort of issue and only competed in one race because of an issue with the car with like a piston or something. But yeah, fascinating. And
fascinating.
If you want to go down the rabbit hole, Raffaella Indy 300, look that up. There's Wikipedia. There's a YouTube video. You can find several articles on the internet about it as well.
I just love those stories of old racetracks. I mean, I'd love to see Dale Jr.'s Lost Speedways continue to grow and hit some other hot points, not just in the South, and I know they came to Indiana for one, but just some of these defunct and completely gone tracks that you can still find little remnants of on properties. I think it's just fascinating, and we're lucky that this one still exists and still hosts some racing
for sure, and hopefully we can have another international race again soon, because Sao Paulo, I mean, that was an amazing circuit.
Yeah, it was. Just lost a heck of a lot of money, which, courses seem to do. But, we talked to Kobayashi, and could he fuel an eventual return to Japan, potentially.
Yeah.
I feel like the next...
Sato could right now. I mean, he is a big deal there.
Yeah, he absolutely is. I mean, when you win the Indy 500 twice, I feel like Japan is a market that I feel gives more attention to the Indianapolis 500 winner than the United States does.
Yeah.
Within mainstream media.
Would agree.
It certainly helps when a Japanese person wins it, but I just feel like it's a big deal to win the Indianapolis 500 when you're in Japan. So could that lead to another race eventually over there? Who knows? But I still feel I had to make a bet. The next race added to the schedule outside of the United States will be Mexico City.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think Mexico City happens probably not next year, but it could even be the year after.
I mean, I see that before another Canada race, or if Toronto goes away, a replacement for Toronto. I see Mexico City happening before that.
Oh, for sure. All right. Anything that we missed? I guess one thing that I missed, Jimmy Johnson was sick, but ended up taking part in Content Day for IndyCar. I guess he had food poisoning or something.
So. Yeah, I heard.
That's not fun.
Just didn't want to face the vicious IndyCar media.
Anything else that we missed?
I don't think so. I mean, it was another week where we felt like not a lot happened, but then when you sit back and start compiling it all, and actually it was a halfway decent week, and another week down before we get to the start of the season.
Oh, I know what I missed. This weekend would have been the originally scheduled start to the IndyCar season in St. Pete.
Oh, so we would have been talking, finally the season starts.
Yeah.
Now we're like, another month or so.
Yeah, another month and a half.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for tweets of the week? We have a few.
All right.
First one from J.R. Hildebrand. Hot take. The Pontiac Aztec would be a successful product today. That camper shell. Yes, I would agree. Would you agree with that?
I mean, the greatest thing about the lasting legacy of the Pontiac Aztec is it was in Breaking Bad.
I mean, that's right.
That was Walt's car.
Correct.
I mean, everybody remembers the RV, but he drove a Pontiac Aztec. That's the only thing I will ever remember from that monstrosity of a vehicle.
This from James Davison, JD33 Davison on Twitter. Call me Ricky Bobby, I'm on fire. And it's a picture of his NASCAR car on fire and his Indy car from the Indy 500 last year on fire.
Theme, yes.
A theme for sure.
And, I always keep an eye on Davidson in watching NASCAR races. I caught most of the race at Homestead last week, a race that really reminded me why I eventually stopped tuning in to NASCAR each and every year. It was just, their first quote-unquote traditional track, and it was boring as all get out. But
and Ferrucci made his Xfinity debut.
Yeah, he did.
What was he, like 28th or something?
I think it was not dead last, but not up to the front. So hopefully it went well for him. But to always keep an eye on Davison, too. We'll see how he does.
Alexander Rossi, in reply to Connor Daly, these comments, and I referenced this in the interview with Chris Medland on Daniel Ricciardo. But if you missed it, I mean, you have to turn left 4 times per lap. How difficult can that be? Rossi said, imagine only having to beat one car.
I feel like I think most everybody took it tongue in cheek, but I know there were some people on social media and stuff that kind of went after, Ricciardo for the comment. It was obviously tongue in cheek. I mean, he knows
for sure
it's hard, but if you've seen any of Daniel Ricciardo on Drive to Survive, I mean, it just fits his personality. It would be something he would say with a smile on his face and giggle. And for anybody to take it serious, like he thought, I mean, he was marginalizing the difficulty that is the Indianapolis 500. I mean, that's just not how I took it. And it was obvious that he didn't mean anything malicious by it.
No, not at all. And last tweet of the week, and this is a reply to a Marshall Pruitt tweet featuring Connor Daly's mullet. And Warwick Roger tweeted, U.S. Hair Force.
I get it.
I thought that was very clever and very funny.
It's very witty, as they say. Nah, he's already shot to the top of the list for the best hair in the series. Sorry, Elio.
That's a strong statement.
Facts.
Yeah, but yeah, facts. I would agree.
Because unlike Elio, that's all natural.
True. That is very true. All right. Well, thanks to Chris Medlin again for joining us. For Justin Kinney, I am Caleb Hatch. This has been New Track Record Podcast.
Podcasts by Federated Media. Podcasts by Federated Media.